You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiatakis. We begin today in the Westlake neighborhood. This is near MacArthur Park, just to the north of MacArthur Park, on a busy block. We're near the intersection of 3rd Street and Bonnie Bray, if you know the area. And I'm standing here on the sidewalk in front of a motel that is under renovation. It is a pretty big motel. It takes up nearly half the block. It's a couple stories with a busted up blade sign and some temporary fencing up front. And we just saw a small construction crew leave for the day. So there appears to be construction going on inside. And I'm here with KCRW reporter Anna Scott. Hey, Anna.
Hey, Steve.
So you brought us here to help sort of unravel a mystery.
Yes. I'm trying to find out what happened to a pile of money that has disappeared into this building.
Oh, do tell.
So what you're looking at is an affordable housing project. The rooms in this old motel are being turned into little studio apartments for homeless veterans. As you can see, it's not finished. It's supposed to be done in a few months. But more than $30 million has already gone into this project, including $10 million from LA taxpayers, which is a lot of money. So who at the city is overseeing this, and where did all of that money go?
Well, all right. It looks like there are some new windows here, a new paint job, or at least part of the building looks freshly painted. But really, from looking at it, Anna, I really can't say where the money's gone.
Well, me neither. And that's why I decided to look into it. And one of the first things that I learned just made me even more curious, which is that before any renovations started, most of the money went into just buying this place, this rundown 1960s motel. I'm not a real estate expert, but it seemed like a lot to pay for this, even by LA standards. So I looked further, and Steve, the story of what happened here raises some real questions about the city's oversight of taxpayer money for homeless housing, including from Prop HHH.
A reminder that the Prop HHH is the $1.2 billion bond that city voters passed back in 2016 to create new permanent supportive housing for people experiencing homelessness, right?
Right. It's supposed to create 7,000 extra units in the city over 10 years, but we're 4 years in and only about 300 units have opened. So where's all that money going? Does the city even know? And that's what we're going to look at through this one motel.
All right, I'm ready.
Are you sure? Do you have your corkboard and your red string? Because it's pretty complicated.
Yeah, we're going to need some pushpins for this one and the red string. So let's go.
Okay. So the first thing you need to know is that this building in front of us is not going to add any new affordable housing to the city, even when the renovations are done, because it was already low-income housing before.
All right, so wait a minute. There were already low-income people living in this building.
Yeah, a few years ago. So back then, this was the Royal Park Motel, a place with cheap rooms and long-term tenants. I spoke to one of those tenants. His name is Peter James. In 2017, he'd been here for about 5 years when he says his landlords told him that he had to leave temporarily.
They said, oh, we're going to renovate. You'll be out for a month and you'll be right back in again. Don't worry about it. We'll give you some money, you know, to tide you over for that month. And you'll be able to move into a nice renovated apartment. I got a $1,000 check. At that time, I needed it, so I took it.
But he says when he tried to return to his room at the Royal Park, it wasn't available. And he ended up living in his van with his dog and couch surfing for months.
It was my first time being homeless. It was really uncomfortable. Just the lack of sleep, first of all. The saddest thing is it really destroyed the dog. She was already old. She went lame from having to be inside the van all day long. So that was the saddest thing.
Eventually, Peter linked up with the Legal Aid Foundation of Los Angeles. Legal Aid sued the owners of the Royal Park on behalf of Peter and several other residents. The lawsuit accused the landlords of illegally evicting rent-controlled tenants. And at the end of 2018, court records show that the owners, a married couple named Gerald and Diane Wang, agreed to pay more than $1 million to settle the case. But they still made out quite well, because according to property records, less than 2 weeks later, the Wangs sold this building for $22 million, three times what those property records show they had paid for it in 2013. And the buyer was an affordable housing developer working with a team to turn the building into apartments for homeless veterans. Some of their money came from LA taxpayers in the form of a $10.2 million HHH loan.
All right, a loan. So Peter James became homeless. Now this building is being turned into housing for other people who are homeless with taxpayer money that was loaned to it.
Yes.
Did the city know about the history of the property and the long-term tenants who'd been moved out? I mean, did they know what they were putting their money into?
They say no. The city's Housing and Community Investment Department, or HCID, told me they thought this was just a vacant hotel and that the people who bought it thought the same thing. Later, they realized the mistake.
All right, so, but they still had a problem, right? I mean, because Triple H money, HHH money, is supposed to be for adding new affordable housing, right? Not turning one kind of affordable housing into another kind of affordable housing.
Yeah, that's right. So with the money already out the door, the city decided to take back its HHH funds and replace it with the same amount from a different affordable housing fund that's not restricted to creating new housing.
So they shifted money, in essence.
Yeah, they just replaced it.
They replaced it. It sounds like an avoidable snafu, to be honest with you. I mean, but all right, so this is no longer an HHH-funded project, but it's still getting the same amount of money from the city.
Yeah, it is.
And $22 million has gone into buying the building from Gerald, you mentioned the Wangs, right? Gerald and Diane Wang, with about half that amount coming from the city.
Right. So, you know how you've heard a lot over the past 4 years about how expensive some of these HHH-funded affordable housing projects are? You know, $500,000, $600,000, even $700,000 per unit in some cases?
Yeah, certainly. We've talked about it on this program.
Well, as we keep following the money into the West Third apartments, you're going to get an idea of why it's so hard for the city to get a grip on those costs. The first thing that happens is on the same day the affordable housing developer buys this building from Gerald and Diane Wang for $22 million, property records show they sell the building again to some of their other partners on the development team for $30 million.
Whoa. Wait a second. So $22 million, and now they sold it for $30
million. On the same day.
Why?
Well, I had the same question, but the developers didn't answer questions I emailed to them about this. I sent the same questions to city officials at HCID. They didn't answer either. So I ran this by three other prominent affordable housing developers in LA, and they all said it sounded really unusual.
They buy it for $22 million, then they sell it to themselves for $30 million on the same day. Does someone pick up $8 million along the way?
I don't know, but the records are clear that the development team making this sale to themselves adds $8 million to the budget for this project in one fell swoop. And some of the funding that they got to pay for this renovation was based on them having to buy the building for $30 million.
Okay, so who are these affordable housing developers?
So there were a bunch of entities involved. There were a couple of nonprofits, a contractor, a consultant. I tried to talk to all of them, but other than a few emails back and forth, no dice. There are two names that are important. The Figueroa Economical Housing Development Corporation, which is a small church nonprofit that was the main developer, and another affordable housing developer they were working with called Blue Green Preservation and Development. I'm telling you these names because here comes the next snafu, Steve. Almost a year after the developers bought this building, twice, LA's city attorney turns around and sues Figueroa Housing and its executive director and the CEO of Blue Green for fraud over another totally unrelated affordable housing deal.
Oh, dear. All right, so let me get this straight. One city department was approving their HHH funding for this motel renovation, and another city department was preparing to sue these same developers over an unrelated project?
Apparently so. And by the way, these developers have more than this one motel renovation. Between 2018 and early 2019, this same group lined up a half dozen other HHH projects too. Altogether, it adds up to $62 million in HHH commitments, and more than $40 million of that is already out the door at this point. After the city attorney sues Figueroa Housing and the CEO of Blue Green, those companies and everyone named in the lawsuit withdraws from the projects. And the other partners, the ones who didn't get sued, scramble to reorganize and they keep going, including with this building here, the West Third Apartments.
Anna, who is overseeing all of this? I mean, is anyone scrutinizing who the city is entering new deals with using all this taxpayer money?
Well, all of these applications go through multiple layers of approval, all the way up to LA Mayor Eric Garcetti's office for the final sign-off. And to be fair, Figueroa Housing and Blue Green have both been in business for decades and had never been in trouble with the city before late last year. But as I dug deeper into their track records, I discovered something else on that question of who. I found out that one of the owners of Blue Green, according to a court document that I dug up, is a person well known at City Hall and not in a good way.
Who is that?
He's a real estate developer named Christopher Hammond. decades ago, he worked on dozens of affordable housing projects in South LA. He was politically connected. He sat on the City Parks Commission. But at the same time, his reputation had a few blemishes. In 2004, the LA Times wrote a whole article about all of the checks that Hammond bounced. Checks to political campaigns, mortgages, contractors. Christopher Hammond did not respond to my interview requests. You can see a running theme here. But I did talk to somebody familiar with his track record.
I'm surprised that if the city gave him a dime based on their prior relationship with him.
That's Bernard Parks.
Bernard Parks, the former LAPD chief and the former LA city councilman.
Yes. He knew Chris Hammond from his work more than a decade ago on a redevelopment project in Parks' district called Marlton Square. And Parks remembers Hammond well.
He had all of the trappings of being a successful developer, a house in Malibu, a house in Los Feliz. In dealing with him, you found that he basically rarely, if ever, fulfilled his commitments, and he always had some drama that turned out later he did not succeed at what he said he's going to do.
Park says with Marlton Square, Hammond defaulted on the project. This has been well documented in other news stories too. It's a whole saga. Marlton Square was never completed as planned, even though a new medical facility did go in on part of the site. To be clear, Hammond's name was not on any of the applications submitted to the city for the West Third Apartments or any other HHH projects. I only realized his involvement with Blue Green after doing a deep dive into court records and finding this one filing where he revealed himself to be an owner.
So could it be, Anna, that the city didn't actually know that he was involved?
For sure. And I've asked city officials if they knew about Hammond's role at Blue Green, but they haven't answered.
Wow. All right. So Blue Green, though, you said, isn't a part of this project anymore. There are other developers that are a part of this project. When is it supposed to open?
Well, it was at one point supposed to be this month, according to HCID records. Now it's supposed to be March. But the project might be in trouble. Back in September, LA City Council members Curran Price and Gil Cedillo introduced a motion asking the city to look into coming up with more money for this renovation. It said the developers are in danger of running out before it's done.
Did the council members, Anna, explain why these developers are running out of cash or how much more they need?
No.
If someone borrowed $10 million from me, like I had $10 million, right? And they said they needed more money. I'd want to know exactly how much more money they wanted and why.
Yes, I would too. And to be fair, the motion does ask the city to find out the answers to those questions before making a decision. One of the people on the development team that's still working on this did email me to say that their financial problems were caused by the pandemic and also by the city delaying construction after that lawsuit against Figueroa Housing and the head of Blue Green. So we'll see if the city decides to double down on this investment.
It's like the city put their $10 million on this little raft, and they set it out into the sea of money, and then they lost sight of that $10 million.
Yeah, and honestly, as I was working on this story, I was surprised that anyone gets affordable housing built, because even under the best of circumstances, financing these projects is so cumbersome and complicated, with developers getting money from all these different places, public and private. The city decided to plug HHH into that system, hoping that by spreading this money around, making it one more slice of the pie, they would help all of these affordable housing developers attract more money from other places and get their projects done faster. That was a choice to disperse the funds this way. City officials say that it worked. The head cheerleader for Prop HHH, Mayor Garcetti, wasn't available for an interview, but he talks a lot about the measure's success. We've heard him on our station. And I did talk to the top person at HCID who told me the city will get the most housing possible by doing it this way, and that they already have more than the 7,000 units they promised in the pipeline.
In the pipeline, for sure. But like you said earlier, Anna, only a few hundred are actually open right now. Even if they do get the number that they want in the end or more, that's a long wait. I mean, particularly when you look at, I mean, my gosh, how urgent the homelessness crisis is here in LA.
Yeah, that's right. And looking at the West Third Apartments, it's not clear with this building if LA taxpayers are getting the most housing possible for the money. What are all the things that you could do to alleviate homelessness with $10 million in 2 years? You could buy a half dozen houses, probably, and put people up with roommates. You could pay rent for hundreds of people for a year at least. And some people think the city should have been more innovative in how it spent its HHH money, like Miguel Santana. He was head of the Prop HHH Citizens Oversight Committee for a couple of years. He was appointed by Garcetti.
And I think that the biggest mistake that has been done is that we didn't change the model of how affordable housing and permanent affordable housing is built.
He said they used a little bit of the HHH money for this experiment where they told developers to come up with a cheap plan and the city would fund the whole thing or almost the whole thing. And he thinks they should have used more of the money that way and that they should take HHH money back from projects that aren't working out.
Instead of how to get their money out of this building, right, the city's talking about how to put more money into this building. Even though 2 years in, the only obvious beneficiaries seem to be a couple of former motel owners.
Yes, there's been no gain so far for LA taxpayers and no gain for the thousands of homeless veterans on the streets who this project is supposed to serve.
This is obviously a story that you're going to keep following, right?
I will.
We've got the pushpins. We've got the red string.
Don't throw those away.
No, we're not going to throw those away. It's an ongoing investigation, but I want to thank you. And by the way, there's more on the website, right? A more detailed version of this story.
Yes, there's a much more detailed version on our website. So check that out if you're interested.
KCRW.com/GreaterLA and KCRW's Anna Scott. Anna, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Earlier this week, George Gascon took the reins as LA County District Attorney. And right off the bat, he delivered on his promise of reforms, ending cash bail, banning prosecutors from seeking enhanced prison sentences, showing leniency to low-level offenders. But some of his staff have been defying orders to implement those reforms. Gascon, however, doesn't seem to be deterred.
There is no question that there are some people that will continue to oppose reform, as they have for many years. Look, the majority of the people in my office, just like the majority of the women and men in policing, want to do the right things. And they're looking for leadership and they're looking for, you know, they have questions, but they're looking for answers too.
That was Gascon yesterday on KCRW. James Quealy has been covering that story for the LA Times, and he's with us right now. Hey, James.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
You bet. Earlier in the week, you tweeted, I've been following your tweets as well, that you were getting a lot of calls about refusals to implement some of these reforms, or at least delaying them. What have you been hearing?
There's been pushback. I've heard from a few prosecutors on the enhancement situation. They are not that they are outright refusing to follow the directive as much as they're trying to delay, at least under Marcy's Law, which is basically the California Victim Bill of Rights, that the victims in these cases have a right to be heard in court before the enhancements are struck. So there's been a few cases where prosecutors have asked a judge to delay ruling on those motions to strike the enhancements until the victims can make an appearance. I have heard of a few judges, and I saw a few judges yesterday also block some of these motions to strike enhancements on the grounds that there wasn't a reason for it outside of the new DA's directive. They were pretty much telling the prosecutors it needed to be due to insufficient evidence or a change in the circumstances of the case or done in the interest of justice. And none of the deputy DAs were making those arguments. That doesn't mean these things will not happen eventually, but in the short term, yes, there has been some pushback in the matters I just described.
So pushback from the department itself and these deputy DAs, but also from judges and victims' rights groups? Is that what you're talking about?
Right. So from the bench, obviously, they, you know, everything Gascon is doing, these are directives. These obviously are not law, you know, and going forward, they will have greater impact because they're pretty much barring prosecutors from initiating any of these things. But changes to circumstances regarding, you know, bail and active cases right now, ultimately that discretion sits with the bench. So the judges can. And like I said, I've heard from some stories out of courts in Long Beach and Inglewood, for instance, some judges have just flat out blocked any of the motions that deputy DAs are filing under Gascon's directives. I have also heard some pushback from victims advocacy groups, mostly with regard to hate crime enhancements. A couple of groups are aggravated at the idea of hate crime enhancements being drawn back because California doesn't have its own felony hate crime statute. So essentially, if someone attacks somebody based on their race or their gender, at least according to my understanding of Gascon's new directives, they wouldn't formally be charged with a hate crime because it doesn't exist outside of the enhancement. They would just be charged with assault, robbery, whatever the underlying crime was. And that has upset a lot of groups that tend to represent marginalized groups.
So obviously, as far as prosecutors go who work with Gascon, are you hearing that there may be consequences for them if they're not implementing these what you say are directives?
So that has, you know, we're only 2 days into this, so that's not terribly clear. This is going to be very different for Gascon than when he, you know, kind of barged in and made a lot of changes up in San Francisco, because there's civil service protections on district attorney's jobs in LA County that don't exist in the Bay Area. I have not heard of anybody being punished for defiance yet. Again, we're, you know, less than 72 hours into DA Gascon's tenure. There also the union down here was a pretty strong opponent of Gascon during the campaign. They have not commented publicly about any of his policies yet. So I don't know, you know, what stances they're going to take if there was to be discipline. But we haven't hit that point yet where, you know, someone has done something and gotten in trouble for it or anything like that, at least not to my knowledge.
And you just heard Gascon say that the pushback isn't unexpected, right? That he knew this was going to happen. I mean, do you think the loyalists will stay and the detractors will leave, that there will be some sort of attrition because of this?
I mean, that would just be guessing there. You know, if you're doing the whole past is prologue concept, you look up in the Bay Area now where Gascon's successor, Chesa Boudin, has taken office, and you have heard of some DAs just leaving the office because they were not going to go along with his policies, or they just didn't believe in a public defender serving as the top prosecutor. Again, I haven't heard of anybody leaving yet, but we're only 3 days in. There are, you know, you do hear some prosecutors talking about they're afraid the younger DAs will leave, but this is also sometimes what you hear inside the LAPD when there's policy changes. You know, you hear complaints that younger officers are going to leave. So some of this, you know, it's a little too early to tell how much of this is kind of, frankly, you know, stock complaining and how much of this is real just yet.
What are you hearing from public defenders? Because I would imagine they're happy with some of these reforms, right?
They're definitely relieved. You know, some of the directives that came out Monday, especially when it comes to, you know, seeking diversion for a lot of low-level nonviolent misdemeanors, as opposed to prosecution, you know, that's been met with joy throughout the public defender ranks. You know, they represent a lot of clients who are homeless, who are mentally ill, who really, truly do need services, as opposed to, you know, a trip to the inside of a jail cell. And, you know, one of the big criticisms of Jackie Lacey's tenure in office was that while she established a lot of mechanisms to help defendants in those positions, they ultimately, those diversion programs, those alternative sentencing courts, they didn't reach enough defendants. So the hope is, based on Gascon's directive, that access to those services will expand, and that'll benefit a lot of their clients. So they are very happy about those things. There's also, you know, a lot of the bail directive has been met with a lot of positive reaction among public defenders, because again, their clients almost universally cannot pay for pretrial release. So seeing, you know, a push towards release on your own recognizance or very low bails in a lot of wider range of cases has, you know, again, a lot of praise from the PD side of things.
Well, the recurring theme seems to be that we're still new into this, right? Just a few days into Gascon's reign over at the LA County DA's office. But I want to thank you for talking about it. James Quealy, who covers crime and policing for the LA Times. James, thanks.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for today. We're online at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Do like your friends and neighbors do, and other Angelenos. Get the show automatically sent to you every day, kcrw.com/greaterLA, and tell us how you're doing while you're there. Jenna Cagle, Angel Carrera, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Mario Saavedra, Desmond Taylor, Amy Ta, Mike Stark, and Christian Bordall all made the show happen this evening. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Have yourself a great night.